Today. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, this is the word of God. If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels but have not love, I'm a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. And if I have prophetic powers and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but have not love, I am nothing. If I give away all I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Love is patient and kind. Love does not envy or boast. It is not arrogant or rude. It does not insist on its own way. It is not irritable or resentful. It does not rejoice at wrongdoing, but rejoices with the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never ends. As for prophecies, they will pass away. As for tongues, they will cease. As for knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part and we prophesy in part. But when the perfect comes, the partial will pass away. When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I thought like a child. I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I gave up childish ways. For now we see in a mirror dimly, but then face to face. Now I know in part, then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. So now faith, hope, and love abide, these three. But the greatest of these is love. Read that far in God's word together. A fundamental truth never to be forgotten about spiritual gifts is that they are worthless without love. We're in our study here of spiritual gifts, and Paul turns the page and has this beautiful chapter about love, and it's fitting within his argumentation about spiritual gifts. So we'll uncover this in three ways. What happens when you don't have it? Point one. What happens when you do have it? Point two. And simply the best. Point three. First, when you don't have it, what happens when you have spiritual gifts in the church but don't have love? The answer is nothing. Or at least nothing good. You might even do damage to have spiritual gifts without love. So in chapter 12, verse 31, as Paul was transitioning from chapter 12 to chapter 13, he was encouraging the original audience of Christians in Corinth to desire the greater spiritual gifts. Remember that from verse 31 of chapter 12? In other words, the higher gifts must follow the excellent way. So the greater the spiritual gifts, the greater the need for a Christ-like character, from which point he launched into the desire for character here in the love chapter. The absence of love is a real problem for the whole architecture of spiritual gifts within the church. Everything that we do, everyone who leads us, everyone who serves us, it's a real problem to have the absence of love. So Paul attempts to describe here the extent of the predicament when a spiritually gifted church has no love, or individually, when a spiritually gifted person has no love. So verse 1, let's take, for example, a person who can speak in tongues, since that's the high interest of the people in Corinth. That's what Paul's being asked about, his tongues. We're going to spend the whole next chapter studying this. Let's take that as an example right off the top. Those who can speak in tongues. And what he means here is a person who can speak well, a person chosen by God, gifted by God in order to speak something on behalf of the church, a person who has language capability. But here Paul means more than that. It's a person who can speak in those spiritual tongues, the phenomenon known as glossolalia. In fact, Paul goes beyond just speaking in tongues and says, what if we have a person who can speak the very language of the angels of heaven? Now, Paul's searching for an illustration of the predicament, and he has found it. We have here an example of an eminently gifted person, okay? That's his point, an eminently gifted person. But what if that person does not have love? Would that person still be a blessing to the church? Well, let's put it this way. The person could still speak to the church because the gifts are there, but with what result? What would be the value of speaking a gift of speaking from a loveless person? The value is illustrated by Paul here as a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. Worthless, but actually worse than worthless, because it's more like damaging. If anything you want to have happen with a gong, is you just want it to stop. Those of you who are as old as I am or older remember something called the gong show. It's probably the only time you use the word gong is refer to the gong show. You just want the gong to stop or to not be sounded. I think the whole point is you want it to stop. When you hear the teaching of a loveless person, you just want it to stop. Interesting. The word love appears 10 times in this chapter. 10 times. And out of all the New Testament references to love, this chapter is known as the love chapter. The New Testament is filled with words about love, but this chapter is well known as the love chapter. It's read in many weddings, as I've said, with good reason. Let's continue to do so. But I do wonder whether the weddings keep the chapter in the context of chapters 8 through 14, where it's placed by God and where it belongs. In other words, what this chapter says about love, it says in the context of spiritually gifted people in the church needing to use their gifts in the church informed by the character of love. That's the context. And if they don't do that, their efforts on behalf of the church are useless. And certainly that applies to marriage. It very much applies across families and extended families and so on. You can provide for your spouse using your abilities, but if you don't have love, it's a sad marriage. Paul gets his point across here about the church with a variety of illustrations of the ineffectiveness of people with spiritual gifts serving the church but without love. Verse 2 has a second illustration. We've already talked about the gong. Now we're moving on. Verse 2, if I have prophetic powers, understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have all faith so as to remove mountains but have not love, I am nothing. Here Paul supposes hypothetically that a person, let's say, he says it first person, I am, but he's not referring to himself. He's thinking, what if I were? It's a hypothetical. What if I were? A person has three areas of massive giftedness in order to bless the church. Skills, schooling, and sureness in God. So the skills, prophetic powers, fantastic teacher of God's word who can really hold forth with an impact. Secondly, a person who has understanding of mysteries and knowledge. This is a person with the mental tools needed and the previous training received in order to sharpen the underlying gifts needed for blessing others. We're talking about a person with both natural gifts, sharp, and also well-trained. But that's not all. There's a third area this person has, the area of giftedness with faith. So much faith that the person could actually ask God to move a mountain from here to over here, and the person would believe that God's just about to do it, that God will do it. It's the kind of leadership and faith that a church sometimes needs to pull through a difficulty and remember the powerful God that we serve. Okay, so this is a person with three areas of giftedness, skills, schooling, and sureness in God, or a personal connection to God. Okay, we got the idea. Ready for the punchline? Paul's second illustration. He takes this person that we've just described and now measure the amount of love that that person has for the church. They have none. Goose egg, zero. No love for the church, okay? What's the result of that eminently gifted person's spiritual gifts being used for the church? What would all of their abilities and faithful serving amount to? Nothing. And that hits us with force. We know it's true, but when you put it that way, Paul, it's really coming home to us. We're starting to get the concept from two illustrations, but Paul has a third one. What about the person who does not have such skill sets, but they have 100% all-in devoted commitment? Let's say this person is not necessarily the best teacher or preacher, not necessarily the best trained person, but they would do anything, right? Let me read verbatim from Paul's own words. What would happen if we had such a person like that, Paul, but they didn't have love? Verse 3, if I give away all that I have, and if I deliver up my body to be burned, but have not love, I gain nothing. Even the person who's committed. This is a verb for as if they parceled out and gave away everything they have piece by piece. Oh, you need a car? Have mine. You need a house? Have mine. You need some clothes? Have mine. And then they have nothing. They gave away everything that they have. That's a verb for doing that. And the person who's committed, but he or she is not motivated by love, then the motivation is obvious. All that's left is selfishness. If they're not doing it for love for God or love for others, they're doing it for themselves. A person wants a reputation of being a super Christian. And they will literally do anything to get that reputation. And so that's not the way to use a personal devotion Devotion is to be spent for the benefit of others. Why? Because as we discovered in chapter 12 already, which is his topic, spiritual gifts, they are to be given for the benefit of others. If we don't care whether others benefit or not, as long as we get our reputation, then we've lost the whole point in the church. And we are the same as the world. In three short verses, Paul has already demonstrated to us that spiritual gifts in the church and service in the church where there's no love is a waste of time. It's an absolute waste of time. Nothing is being accomplished if we don't have love in the church. No gain, no point, no meaning. Paul began his whole giant section going all the way for these seven chapters from chapter 8 to chapter 14. The very first launch of that in chapter 8, verse 1, he wrote this: knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. He's saying the most knowledgeable people, the most skilled people, the most committed people, if they lack this one element of love, for all their work and achievements, the truth is they've accomplished nothing. Paul has shown what happens when we don't have love. Nothing. Nothing happens in the church if it doesn't have love. Teaching doesn't lead to understanding without love. Helping's not helpful without love. Serving is not serving with concern for the welfare of those being served. It doesn't help. It doesn't do anything. Going to Bible conferences is worthless without concern for people to benefit from the topics we study there. Getting training and schooling and even seminary, a degree, is worthless without love for the church that leads to serving the church in a loving way. Acquiring books, reading those books, getting your mind and your notes ready to teach and to preach is worthless without love for sinners saved by grace who will hear you talking. Becoming an ordained elder, deacon, pastor, or going overseas as a missionary is a worthless achievement without love for the church that's placed above love for self. Okay, we understand. We got this, Paul. I understand. I'm blown away. I'm humbled. I'm reminded. But how about we turn to a little more positive direction and come at this from a positive angle and we study what happens when we do have love. And that's what Paul does in these next four verses, which moving on to my second point, when you do have it, oh, what a different story is the church community when we have love. Please note that in the Greek original words, the description of love does not have adjectives. It has verbs. You say, why is he giving me a grammar lesson? Let me read it as it would present itself in English if it were verbs, the way I think that it could be best presented in English. It sounds like this. Love waits patiently. Love shows kindness. Love does not burn with envy. Love does not brag. Love is not inflated with its own importance. Love does not behave with ill-mannered impropriety. Love is not preoccupied with the interests of self. Love does not become exasperated into pique. Love does not keep a reckoning up of evil. Love does not take pleasure at wrongdoing, but joyfully celebrates the truth. Love never tires of support. Love never loses faith, never exhausts hope, never gives up. See, a bit of a difference when you put a verb, an action to it. So keep that in mind as we study these verses for a minute. When we have love in the church, we see a lot of loving action. Love waits patiently. It's a wise understanding that the right timing plays a huge importance in securing the welfare of the other person. Maybe they're not ready. Love doesn't blunder in. Kindness. Love has the actions of showing sweetness to all persons. No envy here. Love doesn't begrudge the status and honor of another person, but instead takes the action of delighting in the accomplishments of other people. Only love can do that. No bragging. It makes no parade for self. In the ancient Corinthian church, there was the issue of status seeking. Paul's been addressing that in his letter. It's at odds with Christ-like love. Also not arrogant. It doesn't cherish inflated ideas of its own importance. Doesn't love to see itself on the front page. Nor does it engage in attention-seeking designed to impress others with its own supposed value. It's not rude. It's an interesting word here. It's specifically in the context of worship. So it doesn't behave with ill-mannered impropriety. It has to do with appropriateness in public worship. It starts out with things like the intrusion of tongues and prophecies, which he will get at the wrong moment.
but also covers many other distracting behaviors. It doesn't elbow its way into meetings, public worship, conversations in a disruptive, discourteous, or attention-seeking way. It doesn't rush in, forcefully imposing personal idiosyncrasies on others for whom those bad manners would be offensive. It's a misunderstanding of Jesus to believe that Jesus raised up nonconformity as a virtue. Compliance is Christ-like. So we Christians cannot excuse ourselves being rude against the rules and social conventions and the polite behavior that is customary in the circles in which God has placed us. Not rude. Further, not insisting on its own way, not seeking self, never pursuing selfish advantage, not preoccupied with one's own interests. True love has an emphasis on Christ and what's best for him and for his church. It has no personal agenda, only the cause of Christ. It's the word agape. So agape love is not looking for its own advantage, but the best good of everyone, the most good, the common good. The person who loves doesn't desire to have the whole world revolve around me. He wants the whole world to focus on Christ. This word, not irritable, is the heart of the word that conveys the force of the English word exasperate. Love is not exasperated or irritated. You know, this is the kind of language we use. Love's not touchy. Love's not sharp, pointed, or acidic. Paul's choice of words here flows out of a concern for selfishness, which is seen when a person overreacts when advocating in their own benefit. And Paul shows that truly loving people can't be goaded into giving a sharp retort of irritation no matter how exasperating the circumstances become. What circumstances? Well, people around who sometimes parade their own gifts, other people around who sometimes nurse their own hurts, but the loving person deals with both cases well. Not resentful. This is the relational accountant, the one who keeps track. This person did this thing to my daughter, that person did that thing to my friend, the person who keeps track. Paul's addressing that. To the degree that a person seems to deserve it, who do you think you are to keep track? Love doesn't have a plan for a reckoning of evil to make things right as if they're the God of the universe. Love remains innocent of any such counting, reckoning, responding, or planning to do. Love takes no notes on who caused what injuries to whom. Instead of nursing the memory of such an incident, charity refuses to notice or to retain the fact that anything bad has happened at all. It's not deception, it's emphasis. Love keeps its focus elsewhere, for example, on what is true, noble, just, pure, lovely, commendable, excellent, or praiseworthy, things Paul wrote over in Philippians 4:8. Love keeps no score of wrongdoings in marriage, in child raising, in anything related to the grandchildren, siblings, extended families, church family, churches in the area, denomination. Love hears no evil, sees no evil, speaks no evil. Love covers, right? It thinks no evil of others, don't even think evil of others. While the relational accountant sets up all kinds of ledgers and accounts and keeps track, looking to pay back offenders in their own coin, the loving soul refuses to see the faults and flaws of others. Then not rejoicing at wrongdoing is listed here. There's a person who's critical, attacking, carping, or censorious, you know, always denouncing, always condemning. Loving a person is not taking pleasure at the behavior that gives us the opportunity to lecture or the opportunity to rebuke how things are wrong. Why take pleasure in rebuking, says Paul? Rejoicing with the truth. Love congratulates and facilitates the truth. Wherever the truth leads us, get the truth out. Love will applaud and cheerlead the truth in others, feels pleasure when others are well spoken of. It's the opposite of rejoicing when they're found to be out doing wrong. Love rejoices at finding out they're doing right and doing well. Love has discovered integrity because love joyfully celebrates truth without manipulative devices. Love is very open and honest, not defensive. The loving person has placed everything in the sovereign God's hands and so has no need to fear when the truth is found out, no need to hide from the truth about oneself or the truth about others. And since God already knows the truth about all of us and God has accepted us, There's no need for us to shy away from the truth. So loving people embrace the truth and rejoice in the truth. If the situation's bad, the loving person finds out and wants to help. If the situation is good, the loving person finds out and wants to celebrate and congratulate. Love does not exaggerate, but seeks to understand the accuracy of the situation and to decide to bear with the feelings of others. And then in verse 7, he ends with this. What a passage. He ends with this in verse 7. Four times he gives us the phrase, all things. There are no limits, is what he's saying. Love removes the limits. It touches all things, everywhere, all the things. So the original Greek presents verse 7 like saying no to negations, like saying no to the fences. Blow down all the fences. We'll go anywhere with this. So verse 7 could sound like this. There's nothing love cannot face. There's no limit to love's faith. There's no limit to love's hope. There's no end to love's endurance. Love puts up with everything without ever ceasing to love. Love never tires of supporting other people, never loses faith, exhausts hope, never gives up. And all the while, the loving Christian has not lost his or her wisdom and discernment. And the loving Christian hasn't forgotten how to distinguish between right and wrong in the middle of acceptance and loving. Love has decided to believe the best about all people and never gives up on people, whatever they do. Christian love is modeled after Christ on the cross. Listen, enduring scorn, failure, and ingratitude with resurrection on the other side, because love always loves again and lives again. How nice when we have love in the church. We got shocked at the beginning with what happens when we don't have love. We get encouraged now, maybe some conviction with when we do have love in the church, which brings us to our last verses, my last point, simply the best. Verses 8 through 13 close out the chapter. In verse 8, we see that love never fails. In verses 8, 9, and 10, we see the phrase pass away three times. Pass away means to fall off. You think in autumn of the year with a tree leaf, which has decayed and lost all of its vibrancy, finally falls off the tree branch. That's the idea of pass away or falls off. So in verse 8, God's final judgment will cause prophecies and knowledge to fall off like leaves. Verse 10, when God completes our knowledge, and the partial knowledge will fall off like a leaf. He compares it to childish thinking. When you became an adult, childish thinking falls away. Okay? Who can have anything to say after God's final judgment has evaluated and pronounced the conclusion of all things? Almost everything falls away when we come into the presence of the living God. So the whole debate about tongues is now set in a futuristic tense. When we all appear before God, he's already said what happens when we don't have love, what happens when we do have love. Now he's going future. He's saying what will happen in the future when we face God. In that idea, to answer that question, verse 8, he says, as for tongues, they will cease. But love keeps going. Tongues is the big question, you see, from the church in Corinth, the Apostle Paul. And here he's saying, in order to answer the question about tongues, let me remind you of basic things. He tells them the gospel and he explains unity, all that in chapter 12. And in chapter 13, he explains love. And love is important, love is paramount, and it never ends. Compare that to tongues. You ask me about tongues. Why didn't you ask me about love? I'll answer you about tongues, but I'm going to answer you first about love because it's far more important. Paul is on point. He's leading the church. When God comes for us, there'll be no tears for Christians because we're loved by God. When God comes for us, there'll be no tongues, there'll be no prophecies, there'll be no speaking of knowledge. The new things appear and arrive suddenly. The new will announce itself as a replacement of the old. When new knowledge comes, the old knowledge passes away. People will not simply progress a little bit towards perfection and eventually get there. Everything will suddenly be revitalized. You won't need prophecy or tongues because our knowledge of God will be supreme. We will know him and see him face to face. So here in verses 11 and 12, Paul explains the infantile is suddenly replaced with the mature. The partial will suddenly be replaced with knowing fully. And so he used to speak and think and form opinions like a child does. As a man, Paul gave up childish ways, and we see adulthood replacing the infantile. As an adult, he can speak and think and form opinions in a way that abandons childishness. He's writing about the future when spiritual gifts such as tongues will no longer be needed. Look at his contrast in verse 12. Now versus then. I'll read them out. Now we see in a mirror dimly. Then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part. Then I shall know fully, even as I have been fully known. What you might not realize is the illustration of mirrors, that the city of Corinth was well known for making mirrors. What an apt application or illustration for Paul. They were not glass mirrors, of course, as we have today. Instead, the ancient mirrors were made of bronze metal. Those of you in the military service, if you had a bronze belt buckle, you know you were told to shine that as much as you shine your shoes. You got to shine that until what? And so you can see your face in it when looking in your belt buckle. Because you can. Bronze can be shined that way. So they had mirrors that they're well known for. And the ancient mirrors were shiny. And for the standards of their day, Corinth did a very good job making high-quality mirrors. But Paul is saying, compared to what you will have is, to understate it, better. You go from introducing a foreign object in order to see the reflection to seeing him face to face. How about that? Paul's showing the church. He's trying to make the church understand small pieces of prophecy, little insights from tongue speaking that you've been trying to cobble together to assemble an understanding of Christ is craziness, foolishness, childishness compared to what we will see one day soon when we see him face to face. You're trying to put tongues in here so we understand God. You're going to see him. The mirror introduces a foreign object, the mirror itself, to establish human perceptions and concepts, but the revelation of God in Christ Jesus will mean, as the Apostle John says, 1 John 3:2, we shall see Christ as he is. And here Paul writes, we shall see him face to face. Not indirectly, directly. Not partially, fully. Not in part, even as we have been fully known, fully see. We started by chapter 12:31, Paul telling us, earnestly desire the higher gifts. And what Paul would show you is a still more excellent way from verse 31. Here now we've decided that the prophecy and the tongues are not the higher gifts, not the more excellent way. So what is it, Paul? We have three possibilities left. It's not tongues, it's not knowledge. The higher gifts, the more excellent way, these three are possibilities: faith, hope, and love. You want to take a vote? Right? Faith will depart when we see Christ face to face. Faith is when we don't yet see him. When we see him, you don't need faith. Hope will vanish when the things hoped for come about and we receive them. But love. Love comes to completion. It comes to full growth in the self-giving form when the perfection and completion of God has been fully granted to us. Love will always exist. It will always exist in the self-giving form in which Christ has revealed it to us on the cross. He gave himself for us to gain us entrance into heaven and the presence of God himself. All the aspects of the church today will be modified. Worship is going to be modified, believe me. Understanding is modified. Faith and hope are modified. The ministries will be redundant. The teacher, the theologian, the preacher, the evangelist will not carry out their work in heaven the way we understand it here. Everything will be modified. But to the extent that we learn to truly love God and love others, to have respect and concern for God and his glory and Christ's church above self, that is grounded in the very nature of God revealed to us in Christ Jesus on the cross. That is the gospel. And Paul says, all that will remain is love. Let's get that straight, and the tongue study will be easy. That's why chapter 13 comes before chapter 14, because love will never become redundant. Love will never become obsolete, it will never become irrelevant, and it doesn't result in the divisions of the church the arguments over tongues will. The fundamental truth never to be forgotten about spiritual gifts is they're worthless without love. We've seen what happens when you don't have it. We've seen how beautiful it is when you do have it, and we've understood that it's simply the best. And in my conclusion, I'll say this. As that church in Corinth went through the difficulties and pain of divisions and arguments, Paul wrote this chapter to ask them one question. What is your highest priority? Of course, the answer is love. But the apostles are careful to define that love by Christ crucified. Again from John, 1 John 3:16. By this we know love, that Christ laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. 1 John 3:16. Love is defined by Christ's death and his love that never ends because Christ rose again. Jesus himself summarized all the law in two commandments. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. The most important command is to love God, and the second most important command is to love one another. And whatever else we discover about spiritual gifts in our next chapter has got to retain this understanding. Everything that we are, everything that we do is designed for the benefit of one another. Loving each other in the church is more important than any spiritual giftedness, any position, any training, any ordination. Any serving in the church is subservient to loving in the church. Loving is not merely one thing among others that we're called to do. Love is like oxygen. Without it, the church dies. Our highest priority is given to us by God to love others in what we say, what we believe, and what we do.